Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Reyes, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Jean Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We'll just take a minute to get organized here, and then we'll get started with the first case on our calendar today. I will just note for purposes of the recording that today is May 14th, 2025. We have four cases on our calendar today, two oral cases and two non-oral cases. I'm Judge Cochran, and on the panel with me today are Judge Reyes and Judge Schmidt. The first case on the calendar today is A24-1621. Mark Lukens et al. Versus Snowman Construction, LLC. The parties will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll just ask that you please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. You should be able to see the time on the podium there, and the podium is adjustable, so feel free to start when you're ready, counsel for appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Ryan Dreyer, and I'm here representing the appellant, Snowman Construction, LLC. And there's really 3 points that I'd like to make today. The first is that there was no exculpatory clause in this contract that we're litigating over in this case. The second point is that the district court erred by reforming or rescinding the change order contracts that we had as part of the project that was in this case. And the third issue, if we get to it, is that if we do get to the damages caused by the alleged improper installation of the patio doors, the district court erred by not applying Minnesota's law to mitigation of damages. So I'd like to start with the exculpatory clause issue.
Before you turn to that issue, I just want to clarify, there was also an issue raised on appeal in your brief about section 6.6 of the contract.
Yes, the mediation.
The mediation provision, yes. And you're not planning on addressing that issue?
Well, I believe we'll have limited time, but we're not abandoning that issue. We believe that the district court erred by not ruling that the Lukens breached the contract by not following the mediation provision that was in the contract. But we really need to focus on the bigger issues in this case today, which is whether or not sections 4.4 and 4.5 of the construction contract are exculpatory clauses. The district court ruled, of course, that they are exculpatory clauses. At least section 4.5 is an exculpatory clause, and then the district court did not apply its language and did not apply the waiver. But the district court erred by concluding that this was an exculpatory clause, section 4.5, because section 4.5 does not eliminate the duty of care that Snowman Construction had when it was constructing this house. In fact, sections 4.4 and 4.5 both expressly talk about the fact that statutory home warranty claims will survive the punch list process that's in sections 4.4 and 4.5. The statutory home warranty requires builders like Snowman Construction to build the home in a workmanlike manner and to follow the building code. That was not waived by sections 4.4 and 4.5. So any claims that the Lukens would have had for violation of the building code or for violation of the statutory home warranties would have survived this punch list process. And that means that the duty of care that Snowman Construction LLC had when it was building this house was never waived. And that is the trigger that Minnesota courts look at to determine whether or not we're going to apply the exculpatory clause construction rules to a clause. If a party's duty of care is going to be eliminated by enforcement of the clause, then we apply the rules of construction to exculpatory clauses. Since for quite a while, and since at least 2022, the Minnesota Supreme Court requires that strict construction apply to the language in an exculpatory clause to make sure that the parties and the consumers' rights are protected and that they have a clear understanding of what is going to be waived.
So how does this clause provide a clear understanding that there's no release of liability for intentional acts by Snowman?
Well, we're jumping right into the construction rules that apply when it is an exculpatory clause. But we got to back up, and we have to determine whether or not this is an exculpatory clause in the first place and whether deserves that heightened scrutiny from the court. And our position, and where the district court erred, is that this is not an exculpatory clause in the first place because the duty of care is not eliminated. Snowman Construction always had to use its duty of care to build this house in a workmanlike manner, to follow the building codes, and that's the same duty of care for the breach of contract, the negligence, and the statutory home warranty.
How do you define the phrase exculpatory clause?
An exculpatory clause, at least according to the Justice v. Marvell decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2022, is a clause that exonerates one party from liability, and specifically with the evil or the public policy that we're trying to promote with this heightened scrutiny on exculpatory clauses is we don't want parties to be able to eliminate their duty of care. That's generally bad in our society, and I agree with that policy. It is bad if parties don't have to be careful when they're doing certain things like building a house. You want parties to be required to use care when they're building a house, when they're driving cars, when they're doing other things that are dangerous. And so these exculpatory clauses are strictly construed if they purport to eliminate a duty of care. But that's not the clause that we have in this contract. The duty of care that Snowman Construction had never was eliminated. For those reasons, it doesn't fit what Minnesota courts have looked at to be the trigger for an exculpatory clause, which is, does it eliminate the duty of care? Does it exonerate one party from all liability? And in our case, that's not the case at all, because sections 4.4 and 4.5 expressly preserve the Lukens' rights to pursue statutory home warranty remedies. And in addition to that, if you follow through the logic of sections 4.4, 4.5, and this punch list process, the Lukens' breach of contract and negligence claims also survived that process. All they had to do was list the alleged construction defects on the final punch list, and then they survived the waiver process. And we saw that in this case, that's exactly what the parties did. Number one, Pam Lukens testified at trial that she understood that's the way sections 4.4 and 4.5 operated. She testified at page 88 of the trial transcript that she knew that if they didn't list things on the punch list, that they'd be waiving their claims to them unless they were statutory home warranty claims.
Is there a final punch list here?
There is a final punch list.
Is there a final punch list that was agreed to by both parties?
That was disputed. That wasn't signed by both parties. I'll grant you that. I think it's Trial Exhibit 9 was the final punch list that Snowman Construction created after it received the email from the Lukens after they moved in. And so there's some debate over what was the final punch list or a preliminary punch list. But if you look at Section 4.4 of the contract, it says that after the owners move in, they have 10 working days to create the final punch list. The evidence here was undisputed that the owners moved into this property, I think it was on March 3rd, 2021. On March 6, 2021, the owners sent the email to Snowman Construction with a list of 12 items that they wanted fixed that they thought were punch list items. And in response, Snowman Construction prepared Trial Exhibit 9, which was the written punch list, sent it back to the Lukens. They refused to sign it, but that doesn't mean they didn't agree to it. They were the ones.
But didn't the district court find that there wasn't evidence of a final punch list? And so you would need to show that that finding was clearly erroneous.
Well, I think that the district court misinterpreted the contract, and so we're looking at a contract interpretation issue here.
Is it really a contract interpretation? Well, it's in part a contract interpretation issue, but I agree with Judge Cochran. This seems to be an issue of a finding of fact as to whether or not the parties had an initial, that's my term, punch list, and then had a final punch list. And that final punch list term is clearly defined, but it has to be based on certain findings by the district court.
Well, yes, I agree, but to the extent the district court misunderstood and misapplied the contract, which is what he did here,
then
Also, you just said earlier that their claims are preserved if the items are on the final punch list. But if there's no final punch list, it seems that you can't argue that Section 4.5 bars the claims.
Well, again, our position is that the final punch list is defined by Section 4.4 of the contract, and it is the punch list that's created after the owners take occupancy of the property. It triggers the 10-day period to create the final punch list. And that's right out of the language of Section 4.4 of the contract. Here it's undisputed that was the only punch list that was ever prepared by the parties.
So there's only one punch list?
In this case, there's only one punch list.
But that's the contract contemplates two different punch lists.
The contract, yeah, contemplates the possibility of two different punch lists. The first punch list would happen after substantial completion of the project is done or when the contractor notifies the owners that the project is done. That didn't happen in this case, and the parties didn't prepare a punch list after that. What the parties did is they prepared a punch list after the owners took occupancy. And under Section 4.4 of the contract, that's the final punch list. And that's the punch list that the parties put together. Again, they didn't sign it, but that's the punch list that they worked off of.
But isn't that a requirement for it to qualify as a final punch list that both parties have to agree to it?
Well, the language does require that the parties agree to it, but I submit...
Okay, so if that's the case, then how can that qualify as a final punch list?
Because there is agreement here, and the evidence was that there was agreement.
But that's contrary to the district court's finding, though, that the parties did not agree to the final punch list.
I think the parties refused to accept that label that this was an agreement, but the evidence was undisputed that the Lukens sent the email to Snowman Construction that had the 12 items on this list. That came from the Lukens. The Snowman Construction didn't create that list. The Lukens did.
Going back to the exculpatory clause, isn't that clause ambiguous because it refers to a punch list, but it doesn't clarify as to whether or not it's the initial punch list or the final punch list?
I think that there's some unclear items in the way sections 4.4 and 4.5 work, and I would agree that it's a little uncertain, but I don't think that it matters if it's ambiguous or not because both parties testified at trial that they understood the way that this process
worked.
But
it doesn't matter what the parties understood. What matters in a contract is what the plain language says, and if the plain language is ambiguous, exculpatory clauses are strictly construed because of the very nature. And if it's ambiguous, then why shouldn't it be construed against the scrivener in this case?
So, again, that assumes the first issue, which is this an exculpatory clause or not? And it's our position that it is not an exculpatory clause because it does not remove the duty of care.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that it is an exculpatory clause. If it is ambiguous, then how does it clarify to the respondents what their obligations are?
Sure. So if the clause was deemed to be ambiguous, then you go into the next layer of contract construction in Minnesota, which is what did the parties intend? And here the testimony from the parties at trial was that they intended the sections 4.4 and 4.5 to work just like it's written, which is that you have to list the items on the punch list, otherwise they're waived, unless it's a statutory home warranty claim. Ms. Lukens testified clearly at page 88 of the transcript that that was her understanding of the way that...
But I don't know if we get into that the contract construction issue, because with a exculpatory clause, it has to be clear as to what obligations that the respondents have. And if it's unclear, then that exculpatory clause, by its very nature, is unenforceable because... It hasn't set out the parameters of what they can and cannot do.
Well, I think that the evidence here shows that it is clear because both of the parties understood how Sections 4.4 and 4.5 and the punch list process worked. And so all the evidence that's before the district court in this court is that it is clear how that mechanism works, and that's how the parties actually performed the contract. The Lukens actually did, after they took possession, issue a punch list, an email punch list of items to Snowman Construction, who put that onto a piece of paper and then went back to the project, fixed 11 of the 12 items. The only thing Snowman Construction did not fix on the punch list was wash the windows. And so that's the only claim that then would survive the 4.4 and 4.5 process. But again, the first issue the court has to address, and this is where the district court failed, is that it didn't analyze whether or not and decide whether or not this was an exculpatory clause. It has to evaluate whether or not the duty of care is being eliminated by this clause. And it's clear from the language here, because it expressly incorporates the statutory home warranty, that sections 4.4 and 4.5 do not eliminate the duty of care. So then we don't get into that heightened level of scrutiny on the language of this agreement. We don't have to look to see whether it's clear and unambiguous.
So your time is running short. I do have a question for you about your argument based on section 6.6. And it appears to me, based on my review of the record, that that argument wasn't raised until the post-trial briefing. Is that correct?
It was raised during trial. The witnesses were examined about it, and I think it was also raised
Was there a request? Was there any argument made that the case couldn't proceed to trial because there wasn't a request for mediation prior to the post-trial briefing?
There were no pretrial motions. I think both parties were trying to keep the cost down on this, but it was raised in the...
So was it waived then, given that if the idea is to prevent the expense of trial, it seems the argument should be raised prior to trial. So given that it wasn't raised prior to trial, was that argument waived?
We don't believe so. We believe it was raised in the answer. It was breach of contract. It was raised as an affirmative defense in the answer.
It only says breach of contract. There's no reference to the requirement to mediate first.
That's correct. There is no requirement or there's no reference to that. And what we're asking for on the breach of the mediation agreement is that the court declare that that's a breach of the contract. And one of the big reasons is because the purpose of Section 6.6 is to avoid all the attorney's fees that happen.
I guess that's what I'm struggling with. If the purpose is to avoid the attorney's fees, shouldn't you raise the argument prior to trial rather than waiting until after trial when all the fees have already been incurred? You could avoid, you know, if you wanted to avoid the fees, you should raise the argument before trial, it seems to me.
See, my time has expired, but I'd like to answer your Honor's question if possible. We were trying, again, to keep the amount of attorney's fees down. Once the contract had been breached...
I'm still not clear on how that works, though.
Well, they had initiated the lawsuit, and we all know the mediation is required as part of state court lawsuits in Minnesota, so it didn't make much sense to stop the lawsuit, bring a big motion, spend a bunch of money on a pretrial motion.
But now here you're arguing that we shouldn't consider there any that all the claims are basically barred because you didn't raise that argument until after trial.
Well, a little bit different. We're just asking that the court reverse and have the district court determine that that failure to comply with the pre-suit mediation requirement was a breach of contract, and there's going to be an attorney fee consequence for that.
Okay, thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is David McGee. I represent the Lukens, who are the respondents in this appeal. They were the home purchasers. Counsel, your honors, I'd like to dovetail into some of what Mr. Dreyer has said so that I can clarify. Number one, the trial court specifically found there was not an agreement on a final punch list, and there was not. And that's a condition precedent to the application of 4.5, because 4.5 is ambiguous on its face because I have no idea what punch list they're talking about.
Well, couldn't it, I mean, if you read the two sections together, though, isn't the only logical interpretation that it's the initial punch list because that's the only one that has a time frame allowed?
Well, arguably that might be the case, but the fact is that there were two punch lists, and the first punch list, Your Honor, was not completed. It was not completed within the 14 days. So is that... Are we bound to that contract with respect to that restriction when they violated that restriction by not completing the work within 14 days? And then the second, the 10-day one, was never agreed to. There was no agreement whatsoever. I'd like to also...
Could you address the argument that Section 4.5 is not an exculpatory clause because it retains the ability to bring a claim based on warranty obligations?
Yep. In fact... In the case Just versus Marvel, the Supreme Court analyzed that clause in that case and said that the broadness of the clause could include a negligence claim. But because a negligence wasn't specifically identified in that clause, we're going to find that it's not, we're not going to hold that clause valid because it's an exculpatory clause. and we're going to say, no, it doesn't bar the negligence claims. In that case, there was an existing claims available, a la the negligence claim, but it was still an exculpatory clause. It just wasn't enforceable. And so you still have exculpatory clauses just because, not because you don't have any other remedies. You might have other remedies, but that exculpatory clause is intended to prevent you from pursuing remedies. And you can have additional remedies like the warranty and still have an exculpatory clause. Because that warranty, if you're going to limit people's ability to bring claims, the claims they should bring, like in this case, negligence and breach of contract, you should have that explicitly stated in that exculpatory clause. You don't get to block all other cause of action and just funnel to the one cause of action that you may like, which is breach of warranty under 327A. So in this case, was it clear to the Lukens that they were giving up negligence and breach of contract cases, claims? I don't see that language in 4.4 or 4.5. And if you look at the just decision, it says specifically that. It says the negligence wasn't identified in the clause, unenforceable. You've got to be explicit.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the language in Marvel broader? I think it talked about any and all claims.
Yes. In fact, it said any and all claims. And so, but in this case, what does it say? It says that you have no other options. That basically under 4.5, you have the builder has no other obligations. Well, to the layperson, what does that mean? What does that mean? It means, I guess I can't bring any claims. Is that what it means? Because in this case, if you're going to say that you're going to bar negligence and breach of contract cases, you got to include that in it so that the person looking at it can go, well, no, I'm not going to sign that and limit myself to 327A claims, which in this case wouldn't be applicable to many of the things that were being asserted. Like the driveway, which is a big case here. 327A doesn't apply to the driveway. So my clients are therefore not given any remedy whatsoever. Now, I did want to talk about the mediation. And the reason I raised this is because it was raised for the first time at trial. And we have been litigating
at
this.
At trial or after, in the post-trial briefing?
Well, there were questions about mediation at the trial, but there never was any substantive argument. It was in the post-trial. So was there questions like, did you guys mediate? Yes, there was questions of that, which, by the way, we did as part of the standard court process. We did. But this mediation, 6.6, doesn't define when that's supposed to occur. It doesn't say that it has to be before trial. It could be before trial, during, or after, by the logic. Because it doesn't say before you can commence litigation, you need to do mediation. And that's a condition. So if they're going to make a condition precedent that we have to have mediation before we can start, then you've got to explicitly state that. You don't just get to say, well, they shall endeavor, which is the word that was used. And so I think in this case, the idea that we should have mediated, I think, is belied by the fact that there is no specific time frame in that provision.
Do we need to address that question if we conclude that the argument was waived because it wasn't raised until post-trial briefs? I think before the district court, you argued that the argument was waived.
Yes.
And you make a similar suggestion in your briefs here.
Yes. We would say, I want to be safe just in case it's considered, but it should not be considered because it's a new argument raised, which, by the way, Your Honors, the argument regarding exculpatory clause, not being an exculpatory clause, brand new argument raised on appeal. If you look at the briefs, and we cited to it, brand new argument that the issue regarding that, well, there isn't, if there's other options available, it's not an exculpatory clause. Brand new argument raised here in appellate briefs.
It seems like they did raise the argument that you're limited to the punch list and warranty obligations.
I think that had more to do with the definition of the contract, what they're claiming is under the contract. But with respect to when we raised the issue that it was an exculpatory clause, the argument was that it wasn't an exculpatory clause. It was not an exculpatory, that the exculpatory clause didn't apply, not that
this, it's by providing other options like the warranty, that it is, that makes it not an exculpatory clause. We're arguing about the nature of the exculpatory clause versus whether it is one at the outset. That's a brand new argument that was brought up in the briefs. I just want to touch base on the change order. The trial court did not make a determination that the change order was rescission of the contract. The trial court found that the change order was an improper modification or attempted modification of the contract, and there was an absence of consideration, because those terms that are in the change order were already in the contract. Therefore, the contractor, 3 months after doing that work, then comes back and says, hey, you know, we're going to charge you for that. Well, the contract itself doesn't allow for that. It says only the owner or my clients can make request change orders. In this case, those two conditions, which one was the utilities and the other was the grading, were well known, were obvious. You could see those as a builder before you enter into a contract. Where's the utilities? Is the grading going to work for this property? In this case, those things were known. But instead of going to and asking my clients, hey, you know, this wasn't worked into the contract, they did the work, then 3 months later, confront them with a change order under the threat that if you don't sign, we're going to walk away. And the trial court says that's an improper modification of the contract because they didn't have consideration and you applied duress, which was an improper and not justified pursuit of legal action. There's a few other points that raised in the briefs, but counsel did not raise them in his material or in his argument here. I did want to touch base on the case, which is Just versus Marvel, which is cited in 2022. Counsel indicates, well, that shouldn't apply because it was decided after the contract. But what's operative in this case was in existence in the case cited in Just versus Marble, which was, I believe, is the Scholbaum case, which was from 1986, which said strict construction. 82, strict construction when you have exculpatory clauses. So the strict construction has been around for a long time. The only thing in Just that was unique is how does it strict construction apply in that case when you have a broad clause that would arguably encompass everything, but it doesn't specify negligence? How does strict construction apply in that situation? So I don't want the court to be dissuaded also by that argument, but also it does raise an issue that this court, in a decision after the Just, had really toyed with whether or not is the decision in Just, it should it be considered now, or is it applied to all new contracts? And it's an interesting argument, and one that I would say, given the nature of the Just decision, it wasn't finding new law. It was applying the existing law to that fact pattern. And as a result, I think we can look at that case and go, yeah, does that fact pattern apply here?
And just to be clear, are you talking about the Lund case?
Yes, okay. Yes. The Lund case, and I think that's an interesting case because I think the court was wondering, okay, how do we deal with it? They didn't have to deal with it specifically at the time. But I do think in this case with strict construction as to exculpatory clauses, you need to apply that standard in Just, which made it very clear, which I don't think changed anything, but just says you can't have broad-based language, which may arguably include negligence, without saying negligence. And all the court in that case was saying is, if you're going to want to prevent somebody from pursuing you on a particular type of claim, you got to name it. Especially breach of contract and damage, you got to name it. You got to give them fair warning that this is what we're giving up by signing this contract so they can make a decision whether or not they want to do it. So I have some time left. I'm happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I can turn it over to counsel.
Counsel, I do have a quick question on the exculpatory clause issue with respect to the it talks about an exception of, quote, punch list items which could not be completed within the time allowed.
Yeah.
And under the contract, the only punch list that has a time frame is the initial one.
Yes.
So why is that actually ambiguous, or does that clarify what punch list, that it's not referring to the final punch
list? Well, it would, to the extent that we render the final punch list meaningless. The final punch list becomes meaningless then, because if I'm going to say all my claims are that the final punch list or the original punch list is an exculpatory clause, then what about the punch list that I'm sorry, the final punch list? The way it was, I understand with the way, I'm sure the way it was intended is you have the initial punch list and you have the final punch list, which, by the way, the time frames on here are ridiculous. I mean, you've got 10 days after getting into the property to come up with agree upon a final punch list, which never happened. And then you get to 4.5, which basically says if you occupy the property, you waived all, everything, but for what you had on a punch list between the time allowed. But it has two punch lists. So if I'm a homeowner, I'm thinking the final punch list is the one that is the one that's the big one, because I've been in there for 10 days. So I agree with you that the interpretation might be there, but I don't think logically it makes any sense. Why would I basically give up all my claims as to the final punch list? And I think that's where we struggle with, that none of these things seem to line up correctly, and none of these things seem to be even realistic in terms of discovering issues. I mean, 10 days after occupying the property, we have to agree on a final. What happens if we don't agree, which happened in this case? So if there's no other questions, I will defer the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Just to respond to Mr. McGee's arguments a little bit, we did raise the issue about whether or not this was an exculpatory clause to the district court. It's in index number 35 at page 10, quote, here sections 4.4 and 4.5 are not exculpatory clauses because they do not completely bar recovery. Instead, sections 4.4 and 4.5 expressly allow recovery against Snowman Construction for one, anything listed on the final punch list, and two, statutory home warranty claims. Again, that's index number 35, page 10. That was the closing arguments to the district court. It was raised by the district court, and that leads into the district court's error for not determining in the first place whether or not this was an exculpatory clause in misapplying Minnesota law.
Respondent argued that certain claims didn't fall within the warranty provision, like the claim related to the driveway. Do you agree with that?
I disagree with that. I think that the driveway is covered by, and the other flat work in the property is covered by the statutory home warranty, and that's only part of the claims that survive the operation of sections 4.4 and 4.5. If they list other defects on the punch list, then those claims survive the waiver process. And so for those reasons, I don't think that it is correct to say that the claims against the driveway would have been waived by enforcing section 4.5. I think we do need to talk about the change orders. That's a big part of this case as well.
Can you point us to any case besides the Marvel case that to support your argument that the language in 4.5 is not an exculpatory clause?
Well, I think pretty much all the, I shouldn't say all, that's too broad. A lot of the cases that talk about these exculpatory clauses focus on whether or not a party is going to be exonerated from liability. And that phrase is common in a lot of the different decisions. Can I point to one single case other than Marvel?
What case do you think is most on point in terms of your argument here?
I think the Justice v. Marvel case is the most on point because it talks about why we're worried about exculpatory clauses and the public policy behind them and whether or not a contract. I mean, the first step of the process is, does this exonerate a party from liability? Does this eliminate the duty of care? If the answer is yes, now it's an exculpatory clause and we have to apply the heightened scrutiny to it and the public policy is at issue. And unfortunately, this is a case-by-case issue for courts and each district court faced with this has to go through this process. The judge in this case, the district court in this case, missed the first step, which is this an exculpatory clause?
Regarding what happens in this scenario if the homeowner takes occupancy, submits a punch list, and 2 months later discovers that there are some problems with the
pipes. Clearly covered by the statutory home warranty, there's a two-year warranty on pipes on the systems in the house, and so they would have a claim under the statutory home warranty to have that fixed, have that repaired by the contractor.
Okay, let's change it then to there's a problem with they breached a duty of care by not, you know, finishing something to the specs that they wanted, but they don't discover it until a month after they moved in.
Well, if it's not a failure to comply with the building code, it's just you didn't follow the exact contract specifications, it would be waived if it's not on the punch list. They have 10 days to figure that out and identify it on the punch list.
So then if there isn't a final punch list, isn't the contractor's option or remedy to bring an action to compel the final punch list rather than arguing that it seems with how do you interpret these two sections together to allow or to bar claims where there is no final punch list?
Well, there wasn't a signed final punch list in this case, I agree. But
let's assume we agree with the district courts that there isn't the district court's finding on the final punch list was not clearly erroneous.
If defects aren't listed on the punch list, they're waived. So if there is no final punch list, the Lukens waive.
Except 4.4 requires a final punch list.
That requires agreement on it, that's correct. And if the parties don't list something on that final punch list or any punch list, they don't preserve their claims to them.
So if a contractor can then just say, I'm not going to agree to a punch list, and then all their claims are waived?
I think that would be, I don't think a district court should apply that. No, I think that's an unfair interpretation of the language in this agreement. I think that would be a pretty sharp practice by a contractor and shouldn't be enforced. I think a contractor has a good faith duty to work with them. Duty of good faith and fair dealing applies to this situation. Have to work with the homeowners, try to agree on a reasonable punch list, and then execute that. And that's what happened here. The evidence is undisputed that happened here.
Is the intentional tort waived based on this? If the contractor committed an intentional tort that isn't discovered until 20 days after occupancy?
I would say, I mean, that's not the facts that we have in this case, but I would say in that scenario that would trigger the exculpatory clause rubric, and we would have to analyze it that way.
So you're saying in this instance, because there was no final punch list, it would be waived?
No, that's not an intentional tort. That's a breach of contract, potentially, or a negligence claim, potentially.
But doesn't 4.5 waive all? I thought you were arguing it waived everything except warranty obligations and items on the punch list.
Correct, but a construction defect wouldn't be the result of an intentional tort. I think that would, I agree with you, I think that if there was an intentional tort, Section 4.5 wouldn't preclude enforcement in pursuit of that intentional tort. See, my time's expired. Happy to answer any other questions the court may have.
You can conclude briefly if you want.
Sure. So based on the arguments in the briefs and today, we are asking that this court reverse the district court's decision and remand for a decision that's consistent with this court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel for both parties. Your arguments here were helpful to the court, and we appreciate the briefing. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.